I've called this talk Changing Institutional Climates, and I wanted to start with a quote that I used for another talk I did in the frame of the Hot Science Global Citizens Project at the end of 2009. This was just before the climate summit in Copenhagen. And it's a quote from Connie Hedegaard, who was the chairperson of that event, and who is now the European Commissioner for Climate Action. And in the weeks leading up to this event, she declared that any failure to reach a political agreement at the meeting would be not just about climate. An outcome which would not lead to a binding political agreement, she said, would show, and here I quote, the whole global democratic system not being able to deliver results in one of the defining challenges of our century. So my talk begins by asking, what is the relevance of this statement from the chairperson of that event for the issues surrounding climate change and its governance in the wake of the outcome of that particular conference? If the institutions that comprise the global democratic system are to follow the rhetorical line of this particular quote, inadequate to meet this particular challenge, what are the kinds of institutional forms that must emerge to face this task? Now, in asking this question, I want to say that I think that climate change does remain a problem of global dimensions, even if I've posed the question about the global architecture surrounding its governance in the way that I have in opening the talk. We might recognise the need for small steps, but I don't think that this should necessarily take a form of a kind of retreat to the local, because if existing institutions are not living up to their role in facing this challenge, we also need to think of ways of acting beyond these institutions, which is to say, I think when dealing with these issues, we need to take a step away from the 1970s slogan, think globally, act locally. I see two reasons for this. The first is because I think that the opposition between action and thought, which this slogan proposes, is one that's increasingly questionable from a viewpoint that looks at the contemporary politics of knowledge and the way that knowledge comes into play, how knowledge acts itself, and how knowledge practices some of the key forms of action that unfold in the contemporary world. But it's also because I think the particular kind of casting of geographical scale that this slogan poses between the global and the local cuts out all sorts of technologies and practices that tend to mediate between these levels. So what we might call the sphere or the arena of global operations, the various kinds of infrastructures and logistical processes that connect and wire up the world through transport and communication, tend to get left out of that picture. And I think they're, aside from the question of scales, which is really a kind of framework that's set up, and from a certain perspective, you know, we can begin to operate without the idea of scales. But to my mind, at least, the reticence to deal with this kind of mediating level is one that's regrettable in terms of thinking about climate change and institutional forms. The question of green logistics, for instance, is one that I'm interested in, and I don't know if people have done any thought around that area or any research into what's happening, but, you know, electronics companies that are trying to come up with models where the particular pieces of hardware remain their property. They can be traced. You've got return supply chains, so these are not going into the e-waste kind of chains, but coming back to the company. It's an incredibly kind of complex business to put in the information and data systems that could accomplish such a return of a piece of hardware at the end of its lease or at the end of its life. But it's an important kind of operation that I think is kind of cut out in these kind of projects that which we all seem to have, which are about connecting the grassroots to the global. Now, when we deal with the issue of climate change and institutional form, it's important that we're dealing with a form of contestation, both scientifically and politically, and this makes it a complex situation. So while we need to recognise that scientific knowledge can be partial, we tend to have moved beyond debates about objectivism and constructivism, which culminated in the so-called science wars of the 90s. So I don't see it as an adequate account of detractor versus defender debates, simply to argue that scientific knowledge is social and political, depending on the values, interests, ideologies, and resources available in laboratories and fields. This position, of course, has been highly contested by those who hold that knowledge is a kind of cognitive achievement that emerges out of the application of rational criteria for evaluating phenomena in the natural or the social world. And now I think we tend to recognise both of these propositions, let's say the objectivist and the constructivist, as kind of right in some respects and wrong in others, in the sense that there always is a kind of political and social context that shapes the outcomes of research, but there's also a kind of relative autonomy to the kind of intrinsic rules and the material constraints that govern how research takes place. And this means that people have moved towards a kind of new understanding of objectivity. As knowledge seems to be objective within a certain field, to the extent that it manages to transform the material conditions within that field. It's objective to the extent that different actors manage to object, transform, and remake processes of knowledge production. So being objective in this sense is to kind of enter a kind of region of objectivity in which there is debate. It's not kind of an abstract qualifying attribute of knowledge, but rather begins to talk about the efficacy of knowledge practices to transform the materiality of existence. Now, from this point of view, the whole question of expertise becomes a really crucial one. So we begin to get the question of who is expert enough to intervene in the production of knowledge, whether we see that as a technical or a political process. And then again, we begin to get the issue, well, how do we begin to separate the technical and political? How do we balance up expertise in these fields? And oftentimes it seems that these are not entirely separable. So the problem is that the structures that tend to facilitate deliberation over a certain controversy tend already to be permeated by the controversy itself. So we can't find a kind of flawless space, no matter how trusted it is publicly or what kind of authority it holds in society, that's kind of a tabula rasa for participants within a debate. We always need to attend to the kind of embeddedness of the structures of communication and the kind of asymmetrical and unequal social and cultural grammars that tend to traverse these structures themselves. So I think this is really an important thing to keep in mind as we begin to think about forms of participatory politics that institutions might perform with respect to climate change issues. Because this whole situation around expertise and where we draw the lines of expertise, what are the borders of expertise, also has its kind of flip side, which is about the involvement of non-specialists, the involvement of lay people, the involvement of publics in debates over climate change and scientific research. And often here the starting point is a kind of normative claim about who does have the expertise or legitimacy to participate. Sorry, it's not a normative claim about who has the expertise to participate, but it's a focus on inclusiveness. It's a focus on the constructive and co-constructive role of publics or of citizens in shaping debates around technological and scientific matters and the public and policy reactions to them. So the kind of aim here is to kind of shift a kind of balance of knowledge and power within a kind of unequal field where these kinds of particular dispositions and positions are arrayed. So participatory approaches tend to function as corrective forces to the shortcomings of existing institutions. The public or the citizens that the institutions seek to include, sometimes at their centres, sometimes at their margins, tend often to be imagined as a kind of homogenous group beyond the main participants in a debate. So we have to ask, well, what does this figure of the public who is supposed to participate, what does it designate? Because it's a very vague term in this sense. It can be a whole nation. It can be the inhabitants of a city or a certain part of a city. It can be a group of people who are affected by a certain technology or a certain application. Clearly it's sort of heterogeneously composed. But one often has the feeling that in participatory events, the people who rock up, whoever they are and however heterogeneous they are, sort of begin to stand as a sort of avatar for a kind of a general public or a general citizenship. So participation of this kind tends to operate in an already constituted form, a field of existing institutional coordinates, which define not only a certain problem, but also who the potential participants with regard to that problem are. Thus, it doesn't necessarily seem to me a form of a new institutional form, an invention of new institutional structures. It can be a step towards it, but I think the debate needs to move on from issues around participation in publics. Now, one particularly rich field for thinking through this is what I'll call assembly politics. It's a form of politics that tends to think in terms of networks, in terms of complex and changing formations of actors, both human and non-human, social and technological, that act within a particular field of debate or a particular field in which we have some kind of emergence of objectivity. And this kind of approach involves a rejection of the bifurcation between social and natural worlds, and it has an emphasis on how these actors arrange themselves in different kinds of networks of connection. So the main concern is to describe these connections and to elucidate the appropriate kind of assembly for dealing with particular issues. And this relation on relations, this focus on relation and connections, tends to correspond to a broader shift in thinking about politics as governance. So that is, politics as a kind of affair of actors, potentially perpetually adapting to and establishing themselves in alliances and networks in others. So governance, in this perspective, it's not about the emergence of some kind of subject that will act politically. It's much more of a kind of asubjective effort of a kind of management that emerges through different connecting actors and the alliances between them. But I think here we need to begin to ask how governance itself acts within contemporary structures of power. How do we ask the question about those who cannot or are unwilling to contribute or to participate to the spaces regulated through such governance? In the climate change debate, these might just be the people who, you know, who are the deniers, you know, who don't come along to things like this. What about those who want to undermine the way in which a network or assembly gets set up with alternative political actions? These kind of actors tend not to be accommodated by these sorts of assemblies, which tend to seem to prefer the kinds of participants who can sort of smooth their way into the network and act within it in productive and harmonious ways. So here again, I think we have to ask the question about how this kind of politics, which concentrates so much on new forms of agency and new ways of doing things, ultimately inserts itself into constituted forms of polities, the way in which networks are ultimately pushed back into spaces such as museums, parliaments, universities, and so forth, which are institutions these days which are very interested in fostering communication between and transformation of the actors that surround them and interact with them. So to return to Hedegaard's comment that I began with, that if you like, recognises the inadequacy of existing institutions to respond to techno-social challenges such as climate change, we have to ask, well, what is the form of action? What is the political form that might lead to the invention of new institutional forms? And what do I mean by this? I'm thinking about attempts to create particular material alliances between particular groups of people, not necessarily the large abstraction which we call the human as opposed to the non-human, but particular groups of people and particular non-human others, and how we might do this in order to confront injustice and establish different kinds of life worlds of material injustice. I think this kind of invention is now going on all around us, particularly through network forms of organisation. We see pursued by different kinds of actors in society. So people like media platform organisers, we see it in social movements, we see it in artist cooperatives, we see it amongst people who organise events which get called unconferences. You know, what's going on here? Why is this particular event seeking to organise itself as an unconference? at least tomorrow. It seems pretty much like a conference to me now, but there's some kind of desire being expressed here, which I think we have to take quite seriously. And I think that this kind of activity is not one that we should think about as oppositional. It's not necessarily a renegotiation of architectures of power, but it's literally a way to try and create alternative forms of sociality and materiality. So new institutional forms, things like unconferences, they kind of exceed a kind of simple definition of opposition to existing institutions. Why? Because they often depend on them. They depend on them for resources. The actors or the participants that are involved in them are often the very same people, you know, who are doing the conference, who are doing the unconference, so to speak. How do we begin to think through that? I think one thing we can say is it's not a strict relation of opposition. But I think that there is some attempt here, and it's a germ of an attempt, and it's certainly an attempt which many could see as inadequate with, you know, to the kind of discourses of emergency that surround the present climate. But I think that it is in these kind of scenarios where we're most likely to see the kind of emergence of new institutional forms that can begin to give us some clues about what might be an adequate negotiation of risks and issues associated with climate change across different geographical scales and contexts. So one of the noticeable kind of dilemma of our time is the way in which established institutions are adapting to a more networked form of society. You know, we see institutions like museums, like universities, like newspapers is a very good example of, you know, the whole question of how the established institution of the newspaper is adapting to a more digital networked environment, how its forms of economic operation can be guaranteed in a situation where people just reading the news off the internet rather than buying the paper. There's all sorts of different models of how to deal with this situation, how to adapt a kind of centralized institutional form to a more kind of networked environment. And museums and universities are also institutions which really face this problem. How do they get networked? How do they adapt themselves to this kind of very different institutional form? And I would say that networks and institutions are not opposites. This is related to my point about this not being necessarily an oppositional politics. But that networks are just kind of different forms of institutions, or that networks can acquire an institutional form would be a better way to put it. So while existing institutions have problems adapting to a networked environment, existing networks have another series of problems. What are the series of problems they have? Well, it's short-termism. It's the weak connections between their actors. It's a question about where might they marshal economic resources. It's a question about their tendency to rely on free labour of the people who contribute to them, or networks to tend to sort of centralise in projects where you seem to have a wide array of participants, but there's a few kind of people, you know, who are gatekeeping the project and who are doing all the work, often, you know, in the late hours of the night. Anyone who's been involved in these kind of projects very well aware of these kinds of dynamics and the kinds of problems there. So this is where I see that there's fertile ground for collaboration and intermeshing, not in a between existing institutional forms and new institutional forms. Not that the latter are in opposition to them, but rather that they both have something to gain out of each other. The existing institutions understand how to get networked, whereas the network forms understand how to set themselves up as institutions with some form of sustainability and the potential to deliver innovations. So I think I'm out of time, so I will leave it there. That's a kind of very general kind of picture of the question of changing institutional climates as I see it. Thank you.
Excellent.